Please be seated.
Good morning and welcome to the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have two cases for the 9 o'clock docket. Council are ready to proceed in JetTech versus Shaden. And our council checked in on Orto v. Shelter Insurance.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Have all council received our written statement of procedures? Does anybody have any questions? For spectators, if you would please turn off any cell phones or similar devices so the lawyers are not interrupted. Otherwise, we're ready to proceed in JetTech versus Shaden.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Mike Poindexter. I'm counsel for JetTech LLC, doing business in this case as Beach Jet Tech. We're here today because apparently I need some clarification on the law of consideration. That's all this case is. That's all it boils down to. Consideration goes back to the roots of the common law. When I was in law school, we read a book called The Death of Contract. That was about the reliance interest taking the place of consideration. That's not this case. There's no reliance alleged here. There's no change of position. What we're looking at is, can consideration be something in which you have no legal ownership interest? Because it's undisputed that the defendant in the case, Shaden, sent JetTech a $70,000 check. It's undisputed that JetTech cashed it. It was not Shaden's money.
It's also undisputed that Shaden sent a letter saying cashing of the check is a release of all your claims.
Absolutely.
And your client cashed the check without any protest, request for explanation, or the like.
Absolutely. And as Your Honor well knows, protest would have been futile. The law is clear. You take a check that says full and final payment. You can't cross that out or make a note saying it's disputed. If you cash it, it's done. You know, the question in this case is, can you give something that you don't own as consideration? Now, it's like a lawyer's trust account. It's like a kidnapper holding a child. Could a kidnapper give a child back to its parents and say, by taking this child back, you waive any civil legal claim against me? It's like a bank holding a standard depository savings account and then having a deal to make a loan to a customer and falling through on that deal and being exposed to a lender liability claim and saying, oh, by the way, we're freezing your account. If you want any of your savings account back, you've got to release us from this lender liability claim. So it's a question of, can you give something that you have no valid legal ownership interest in as consideration?
Mr. Poindexter, was there any dispute as to whether this contract could be terminated? In other words, your client, as I understand it, wanted to terminate the agreement, and Shaden wanted to continue to work on the project.
No, sir. That's not correct.
All right.
After January the 20th, the date that the FAA had set for compliance with these standards, it was neither party wanted to continue working on this agreement. And I can't cite to the record right now, but there are letters back and forth from Shaden to Beach Jet Tech and emails saying we're not going to do it. So
now, whether either party wanted to continue the agreement,
yes,
What did the written agreement say? Was this
the written
contract,
agreement?
Was this contract done, terminated as of under the written agreement?
No, the contract was a very informal letter of agreement, and it didn't speak to that issue at all.
So now, under the written agreement, then we don't know if the contract was terminated automatically. But after January 20th, it's your position that the record says both parties want it to terminate.
I believe that's the case, Your Honor.
Okay.
The second agreement, though, that dealt with the deposited funds of my client's clients was a separate letter, and it did specify that these are segregated funds to be returned in the event you cannot comply with the original contract by January 20th, the FAA deadline. So the second letter that governed these deposited funds did speak of a termination date, if you will.
And there was consideration for that agreement?
Yeah, because on the same day, plus or minus a day, my client sent an irrevocable order for 10 ship sets that he had not previously given. So that, I believe that's the consideration for the promise to return the deposited funds.
Thank you.
Isn't Minnesota law contrary to your position insofar as that it says, at least as I read it, a wholly liquidated claim can be consideration for an accord and satisfaction if it's clearly understood that payment of that claim constitutes a release of additional claims?
You know, Your Honor, it's interesting how that line developed, because Minnesota law and to some extent Colorado law developed from the fact that in the bad old days, if you will, if you had a liquidated sum, you couldn't get off of it by paying part of the liquidated amount. The law of accord and satisfaction only applied to disputed sums. And if you paid, if you had a promissory note for $5,000 and you paid $2,000 in full settlement, the law wouldn't let you do that. That's been universally transformed into a situation where, yes, you can settle a liquidated sum for less than the liquidated amount if you clearly state that. And that's what Minnesota law.
How is that different from what happened here? Why is
because
your,
this
why is your $70,000 deposit that you claim an entitlement to get back mm-hmm. any different from a $70,000 promissory note that you have an absolute obligation to pay?
Because Shaden had no legal right to the $70,000 in customer deposits. They had no legal right to it, just like the bank has no legal right to keep your savings account and use it as to satisfy a claim for breach of a lender liability thing. It's just a question at the trial court. There was a very interesting analogy brought up by defense counsel that I thought was appropriate, and that is a painter signs a contract to paint your house for $5,000, and when it's done you say, I don't like the job, I'm going to give you only $2,000 for it. Well, you also say, and I'm going to keep the $2,000 worth of ladders and sprayers and equipment that you left at my house. I'm going to lock that up in my garage, and you're not going to get it back unless you take this $2,000. If the painter took the $2,000 and that was all that was offered, then it's a done deal. I agree. That would be consideration for a liquidated amount for less than the amount stated. But to give somebody something that's theirs, not yours, but theirs, and claim that that's consideration for a settlement, I don't think is the law. And I think it turns the concept of consideration on its head. As I told,
let me ask you, Mr. Poindexter,
yes, sir.
How is it that the $70,000 was theirs? Here you're saying was JetTech's. How is it that it was jet tax, and when did, and at what point did it become jet tax?
These were deposits received from jet tax customers, sort of payment in advance, down, you know, earnest money, if you will, deposits that were forwarded to Shaden under their agreement of March 8th. And Shaden held those deposits as earnest money, if you will, subsequent or subject to fulfilling the contract, producing these air data computers, and supplying them to the customers.
And was that $70,000 then to be part of the payment for those for that equipment?
Yes, it was. At the time that Shaden supplied the chipsets, then the money would become theirs, like money in a lawyer's trust account.
So it would be your position that Shaden was holding that deposit in trust for your client?
More or less a constructive trust.
Well, is there any language in any of the letter agreements that required Shaden to do anything specifically with that money, such as in a real estate, you know, real estate agent will put an escrow
account? Yeah, it was not.
So, I mean, it's really not like an escrow account or a
It was not account. Put in a separate escrow account.
In fact, wouldn't it be the fair understanding that Shaden would use that money in the ordinary course of its business to work on the project, but would be required simply to make a refund if the contract folded?
Well,
I mean, you don't expect him just to do the work on their own capital and leave the 70 grand sitting there someplace.
Well, the cost of this project dwarfed the $70,000. It's not like the $70,000 was necessary seed money for Shaden or my client to proceed. But, I mean, there's a fine line, because it was not in a separate escrow account, but it was also not earned until the product was completed. And pursuant to the second letter, which is Exhibit G, page 2, there was a specific agreement to return those monies in the event that the primary contract couldn't be honored. So, there is a line there, Your Honor, but you're talking about expectations of the parties. I don't think there's any evidence on the record of what that is. As I see it, it's a matter of law. Did Shaden have, obviously they had a possessory interest, just like a kidnapper has a possessory interest in your child, or a bank has a possessory interest in your savings account. But did Shaden own the money? Did it have a legal right to say, I am giving you something that is mine? And I told Judge Stern, if Shaden had sent $10 in addition to the $70,000, then here's your $70,000 back, and in addition, here's a check for $10, and the full and final settlement of the case, I wouldn't be here. But I'm here because they didn't have an ownership interest in the $70,000. It wasn't theirs to negotiate with. It wasn't part of the undisputed damages. It was part of a separate amount set forth in Exhibit G, saying we will return this if we can't complete the primary obligation. It's a tough question, I understand, and I hope that your opinion, whichever way it goes, enlightens me on the subject, because it's not clear in this jurisdiction or in Minnesota at this point. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Peter Gleipel, Minnesota Attorney Registration 0149834. May it please the court, counsel. We have a significant difference of opinion with plaintiff's counsel as to whether or not the $70,000 was, as he's argued, in trust, or that Shaden had no right to the money. If your honors, I'm sure you have focused on the letter of understanding, There is nothing in the writing that mentions trust, expressly or implicitly. There's no relationship, none on the record, between my client, Shaden, and the plaintiff's customers. What the plaintiff was obligated to do under the letter of understanding was manyfold. It was to identify 5 test aircraft, and upon identification of those test aircraft, pay to Shaden $38,000. It was then, in addition to that, to pay for every deposit to hold the place $20,000. Now, with respect to Exhibit G, page 2, the plaintiff's counsel points to, at best, it's an amendment of the letter of understanding that in the event the January 20, 2005 FAA RVSM deadline had passed and Shaden hadn't produced the ADCs for the beach jet, plaintiff then had the option to ask for $70,000, the amount that it had paid to Shaden. I think Your Honor accurately points out from an economic, from a common sense point of view, given the nature of this project, that while the project may have cost more than $70,000 to design and develop, I think it's pretty clear, and common sense would indicate, that by contractually obligating the plaintiff to deposit 5 times $38,000 for test aircraft, and in addition to that, pay to Shaden $20,000 for any additional orders, that the parties, to some degree, although lesser, to a lesser extent, the plaintiff, was providing capital, was providing monies to develop this new product.
You don't dispute that plaintiff was absolutely entitled to the $70,000 back once the FAA deadline lapsed?
I don't dispute it if plaintiff had exercised its right once the January 20 date passed. But the record also indicates that in November, Mr. Randall of my client offered to the plaintiff, as well as other clients, a return of any monies, because it was clear at that time that the January 20 date was not going to be met. And thereafter, the plaintiff communicated, as the record would indicate, that I'm not asking for my $70,000 back. I'm going to stay on. Now, what then happens if we fast forward is that the plaintiff himself testified that on March 14th, of 2005, 15 days prior to the letter in settlement and tender of the $70,000 check, he considered the relationship to have been terminated. There's nothing on the record until March 29, my client's letter, that Shaden agreed and was terminating the relationship.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm not following this. Did you argue to the lower court that the communication in November was a waiver of the right to get the $70,000 back if the deadline was not met?
I believe we did.
Okay. Did the trial court make any findings in your favor on
that? It did not, Your Honor. Okay. It did not. I think the key, and I don't think the question is as difficult as plaintiff's counsel has surmised. On page 13 of the plaintiff's brief, its opening brief, the plaintiff recognizes the $70,000 payment by Shaden to plaintiff, and I'm paraphrasing that part now, was to compromise what was obviously a disputed claim. And I think that is the key here. Whether this court decides to analyze it under Minnesota law, which I think the court has accurately pointed out, the Minnesota law is clear. I think the plaintiff has implicitly recognized that in his briefs when it has argued that Minnesota law doesn't apply, because the cases that we've cited from Minnesota law make clear that there is an accord and satisfaction here. And I also believe that the law in Colorado also recognizes that there was an accord and satisfaction here. The Colorado Supreme Court in Hudson against American Founders at 377 Pacific 2nd 391 at the Penn site 396 recognizes that it's necessary that money should be offered in full satisfaction of the demand and accompanied by acts and declarations that amount to a condition that if the money, if accepted, is accepted in satisfaction, and it must be such that the party to whom it is offered is bound to understand therefrom that if he takes it, he takes it to such condition. Now, if we then focus on the settlement communications that began in early February of 2005 from plaintiff's counsel and Mr. Poindexter to Shaden's counsel, there clearly was a dispute. And there were settlement communications that were communicated in writing.
Okay, excuse me for interrupting.
Sure.
Was the dispute over getting the $70,000 back, or was the dispute over additional economic consequences of terminating the relationship?
Well, I think it depends on from whose perspective, and I'm not trying to be disingenuous. It was with respect to both, because the...
Well, did your client ever, because most of this is in letters, did your client ever send a letter to JetTech that said, you're not entitled to the $70,000 back?
They never sent a letter.
Okay.
It did
and
not.
Was there any testimony that your client orally informed JetTech that they weren't entitled to the $70,000 back?
No. But what the record does indicate, again, is that on March 14th, Mr. Irwin, the plaintiff, had considered the contractual relationship terminated. And I think importantly, with respect to the law of an accord and satisfaction in Exhibit W that accompanied the check, is that the contractual agreements between the parties were terminated, such that the check that was tendered with the release language, the conspicuous language, made clear that it was being tendered in full and complete satisfaction of all perceived contractual arrangements. And if it was the plaintiff's position that the $70,000 was not in respect of a termination of all contractual agreements and a release in respect of all those contractual agreements, then the plaintiff should not have endorsed and negotiated the check.
Mr. Gakel, when did the contract terminate?
The contract terminated with plaintiff's acceptance of the check and the terms on which the check were conditioned. Because up to that point, Your Honor, my client was still performing. Mr. Irwin, as the record will reflect, had not communicated but had determined in his mind as of March 14th that the relationship was terminated. But the record will not reflect that the plaintiff at any point prior to that time had ever communicated that there had been a termination. In fact, the record will further reflect that up to that point in time, the parties were communicating with respect to the status of the project and the fact that my client was focusing on what was called the Cessna solution, which was going to be the platform for the Beach Jet and the Gulfstream.
But that would have been a modification, would it not?
It would have been in part a modification. I am not a software engineer. The thought was that we could use certain aspects of the Cessna solution with respect to the Beach Jet solution, both with respect to the development and the FAA approval.
And then on March 14, when Mr. Irwin says, I want to terminate the agreement, could he do that? Could he simply unilaterally say, we're done, it is terminated?
Not without being in breach, because the letter of understanding does not contain any term that would entitle a party to declare unilaterally a termination.
Isn't that implicit in agreeing to return the deposits, that the contract's terminated? And if you've got an agreement that says, you know, the JetTech is entitled to the deposits back if the FAA deadline isn't met in January, I mean, isn't the necessary implication of that that JetTech is allowed to thereby terminate the contract?
If it had availed itself as of January 20 or on or about January 20 of 2005, having not availed itself of that right, but rather continuing on in the relationship, demanding performance, communicating with us, and Your Honor, with respect to the March 14 date, and we note in our brief, Mr. Irwin had in his mind determined that the relationship was over. The testimony at trial was that he had determined it was over, not that he communicated that it had been terminated. This is while counsel were negotiating and the settlement offers were being exchanged.
Were there specific demands for performance by JetTech on your client between lapse of the FAA deadline in January and March 14th? Now, I said demands for performance, not just questions about what's going on.
I believe, Your Honor, was there any writing to answer your question directly? No. Does the conduct absolutely at trial demonstrate the expectation and therefore a demand that my client continue with the development of the project? Yes.
You know, what by what conduct between January 26th and March 14th did JetTech demand that performance continue?
From that date through February, first part of March, the record will reflect that Mr. Irwin was communicating with both Mr. Randall and Mr. Rita, pushing them in respect of certain tasks that were required to be accomplished to bring the project to fruition.
Okay, so is it basically your position that communication was at least arguably a waiver of the January 26th deadline, and therefore JetTech was not absolutely entitled to get the 70 grand back?
Absolutely.
Okay, and that's the dispute that's being settled from your perspective.
Absolutely, and I believe that plaintiff has recognized that, not to beat a dead horse, but at page 13 of its opening brief, again, where it admits that this was to compromise, and I quote, what was obviously a disputed claim. That's not my client's words. That's the plaintiff's position. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I'm finished.
Let me ask one more thing. And so before that check, does the record have information about negotiations related to an alleged breach of contract? In other words, before the end of March, can we look in the record and find either testimony or documents that say that there was any discussion about a breach of contract by Shaden?
The only, I believe, Your Honor, the only evidence in the record would be what started in February with the first letter from plaintiff's counsel, Mr. Poindexter, wherein there was a two-part either or offer to resolve what was then a dispute. And there was a letter, I believe on February 3rd, from Mr. Poindexter. My client then followed up with a letter saying, we're not in complete understanding as to what your proposal is. There's a subsequent letter, I believe also near the end of February or the first part of March, where Mr. Poindexter then clarified what the offer was, an either or, either pay back the 70 and continue, or buy my client out of what he perceived to be his investment in the project to the tune of approximately $200,000. And then what was culminated with the March 29 response to that settlement offer of the check, the recognition that all perceived contractual arrangements had been terminated, and the conspicuous release language on that March 29 letter.
And succinctly, if you would, why wasn't the failure to deliver on January 12th a breach? Or was it?
I don't claim it was a breach because the original letter of understanding did not provide a drop-dead date. It did not provide that time was the essence. Indeed, Exhibit G, the plaintiff relies on, doesn't claim that if the January 20 date passes, that there's a termination of the contract or a breach. It provides that if the January 20 date passes and the plaintiff requests the money, the deposits will be returned. But it says nothing about that would act as a termination of the contract. The parties were free at that point, if they had decided hypothetically, to continue on with the project without Shaden holding or using the money that had previously been paid by the plaintiff.
So if the contract had continued during that time, even if there was an anticipation of a potential breach, all JetTech had to do was say, well, in accordance with our agreement, please return my $70,000, but the contract, you can continue to work on the contract, you just don't have the right to hold my 70 anymore. Is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow. Would you mind restating that?
If I understood what you said, you're saying that as of January 20th, the agreement between the parties was that JetTech could, as of that date and later, simply say, please return the $70,000. And upon saying that, that doesn't mean the contract would terminate. The contract would continue, and Shaden would continue to work on the contract. It just would no longer hold the $70,000.
Agreed.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've got a minute and 49 left.
It's significant that the Exhibit W, the March 29th letter from Shaden's counsel, does not offer a mutual release or termination. It simply proposes a unilateral release, so that it proposes to keep any claims it might have against JetTech. There is nothing mutual offered in that letter. Secondly, I don't think I have anything else to add unless you have a question. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion.